not write all of that.
Uh-huh.
And I also never sleep. That's how I do all of that stuff. So, all right, thank you so much for being here, really. Here we go. So we're going to talk about the science of motivation today. And I'm going to try to keep it as minimally scientific as possible and as maximally productive and practical as possible. Because what you don't want to go home with a bunch of scientific terms to memorize. You want to go home with, what the heck am I supposed to do? Right? So thank you for being here. Thank you for carving out time in your life and for selecting this particular presentation. I know you have many options. I feel like an airline. You have many options when you fly. Maybe I'm picking this one. Thank you. Thank you so much. So when my wife and I were dating, we were getting more serious, talking about how much we liked each other and whatnot. And she came up to me and said, okay, so when you propose to me, here's the ring that I would like. This really happened. Okay. And I went, okay, cool. That takes away my need to make a choice, so that's fantastic. And then I won't mess up either. She'll go, that's the perfect ring. And it will be. So I went to the jewelry store where they had this particular ring. And they happened to be having a sale. And I went, great, my practical man side kicked in. And I thought, okay, this is great, because I can get this ring at a little bit of a discount, so I've saved some money. And if things don't work out between me and this girl, then I can probably get, you know, most of it back, and then I'll buy a different one later. Okay, this is how, so romantic, wasn't it? This is kind of what I was thinking as a 26-year-old man at the time. So I buy the ring, and I'm kind of planning, how am I going to propose and all of this stuff. And then my wife's family, who are like somewhere between ninjas and spies, go to the jewelry store to go look at it just to kind of remind themselves how cool it is, and it's gone. And I said, look, I know this lady and her family, they're going to come in here and they're going to wonder where it is when I buy it. Just tell them you sent it to another store and that somebody else bought it. So they all went in, and he tells this story, and my wife's sister, who's much like my wife, says to this guy, she doesn't even know this guy, she looks right in his face and says, you liar. He was like, oops. So through a number of events, I found out that my wife's family knew that I had the ring, and they were just waiting on me to propose. And they were actually, I could tell they were getting a little bit annoyed. I was taking too long to do this proposal. And so I decided that I was going to wait to propose until I was certain that they weren't sure anymore whether I was actually going to propose. I waited 2 months from the time I bought the ring until the time I actually proposed to my wife. So the question that we might ask ourselves is, why on earth would I allow other people to have that much influence over a decision that was really about me and her and had really nothing to do with them? Now, we all are a little bit of scientists when it comes to motivation. Because we ask ourselves questions like, well, why on earth did she do that? Or what would provoke him to make that decision? We're all wondering about people's motivation. Sometimes it feels like it makes perfect sense, and sometimes people do things that seem to, it makes absolutely no sense of why they're doing what they're doing. So the thing that's important to come to terms with is that human motivation is actually really, really complex. And I'm going to try to simplify it down today with a theory elegant enough that it explains much of human motivation without being too complicated. That's the goal here. Now, this is not my theory. This is information derived from a scientist, a researcher by the name of Dr. Torrey Higgins. And he is a professor of psychology and business at Columbia University. And he has spent his entire career studying human motivation. And his basic thesis is that most of us, when it comes down to it, believe in one of the ancient Greek philosophies called hedonism. And most of us believe that people make decisions based on a desire to maximize the amount of pleasure they experience and to minimize the amount of pain they experience. Now, it's not a terrible theory, because you can explain reasonably well, what a lot of people do, a lot of choices people make based on hedonism. But it doesn't explain everything. In fact, it doesn't even come close to explaining everything. Let's give an example. Marathons. Marathons make absolutely no sense whatsoever. You can get in a car and be there in like 20 minutes. And then you'll have the rest of the day to do whatever you want. Okay? They don't make any logical sense, and they certainly don't make any sense when it comes to hedonism. Because marathons, to my knowledge, I don't know this from personal experience, but I hear that they're pretty painful, and they can be pretty punishing on the body. In fact, people have died from trying to run marathons. Okay? So we can't really explain marathon runners by hedonism. So we need a theory that explains why people do what they do outside of this concept. So we're going to tell a better story, and that story is about effectiveness. That a sizable majority of human motivation is a desire to be effective, not to maximize pleasure and minimize pain. Pleasure and pain simply become indicators of whether or not you're being effective. And there are three key areas where people desire to be effective. And we're going to talk about those. And the goal here is to help give you some theoretical concepts, and then we're going to apply it to recovery. But you can actually apply this to parenting. You can apply it to goals that you set for yourself. Just about anything where you need to find some motivation to do something. So, here we go. The first is truth effectiveness. And this is a desire to establish what is real. People who are after truth effectiveness, and we all are, want to know that they are capable of discerning what is actually true about themselves, about their relationships, and about the world around them. Now, truth is really important because if we don't know what is true, then we can't make very good decisions. Okay? So if I'm an ancient human being with a spear and I'm going to go after a woolly mammoth, for example, for lunch, if I can't determine the truth that this thing is going to smash me if I go up against it, then I'm not going to make it very long. And so, even in the most sort of primitive of circumstances, I need to be able to determine what is real to help me make rational and good decisions. And it's not just about decision making. There is something inherent in the human soul that desires to know what is real. You can tell this because of how incredibly intensely people talk about things like religion and politics, right? And how desperately you do not want to talk to those people, because it's not, with politics, for example, to me, I think most people's intensity is less about their concern for the proper way to govern humanity or society. There's some value, there's something there, of course, but I think people are really, really interested in making sure that they're perceiving the world accurately. They know how to discern truth. And that motivates people to do a lot of things. Some recovery examples of truth effectiveness that you might want to establish about yourself would be something like this. I don't have to remain trapped in my cycle. I'm capable of getting out of my cycle. I'm valued. I'm loved. I'm important. I can tolerate and empathize with other people's pain. I don't just have to shut down or run away or try to make it better for people. I can sit in people's pain. I can trust God. Now we know that truth is a motivator independent of pleasure and pain. For example, because in a recovery context, I'll often talk about doing a full therapeutic disclosure with my clients. and that is that the addict writes the history of the addiction, the history of the denial, all of the things that he is told that are not accurate. I said I was here doing this, but I was actually over here doing this instead. And a partner feels very, very driven to experience this disclosure, even though she knows it's going to be painful. Truth is a greater motivator to action than the desire for pleasure. Okay? Your minds are starting to open up to new concepts. This is good stuff. All right. Now, this is also why when I sit with the women in my office and say the words, "You are not crazy," so many of them, I've had women cry in the office, and so many of them breathe an incredible sigh of relief because they've been trying to establish truth effectiveness around their sanity for the years that they've been living with an addict. Because addicts are so good at making you feel like you are insane. And they can even provide beautiful, glorious evidence of all the ways you are crazy that are really hard to argue with, because addicts are so good at arguing. They've spent their entire lives practicing, okay? And they enjoy it a lot of the time. We can talk about why that is later. But when I say, "You are not crazy," then women will believe me, because I've been doing this a long time with a lot of people. And it's relieving to know that what they believe about themselves is real. Side note, never ask an active addict for feedback about anything, because they are terribly impaired, and their feedback is not usually very relevant. All right, next one is value effectiveness. This one can be a little bit complicated to understand, but I'll do my best to explain it. Value effectiveness is knowing that you are capable of obtaining desired results, getting things that you value. Can I get what I want? Okay? Meaning, if I have value effectiveness, I feel confident that if I put in effort into something, it will yield something for me. If you've ever grown food in a garden, and you know what it's like to feel value effectiveness. I put these seeds in the ground, I watered them, I took care of them, and they grew into something beautiful that I could experience. That's value effectiveness. I can get what I'm after. Okay? So, let's talk about this for a second. This seems a little bit like hedonism in some ways. Can I get what I want? Right? Can I get what I'm after? Some people might even experience some twinges of feeling selfish. Well, I shouldn't be able to get what I want. That'd be selfish, right? Sometimes you experience that from an addict. You've learned that your needs are selfish, and his are perfectly rational, right? Except they're not. Okay. So, as far as value effectiveness goes, the thing that's more important than actually getting what you want is knowing that you have the ability to get what you want. That's the sense of effectiveness. We're not just talking about getting the things you want. We're talking about the fact that you know that your efforts will yield results. Okay? And it's more important than actually getting what you want. This is about control effectiveness. Wouldn't that be so fun?
Yeah.
Okay, that's actually not the right slide. This is the kind of control effectiveness I'm talking about. Okay? Control effectiveness is not so much about the destination, but about how you get there. I bet there was a much easier way to get to the top of that vista for that woman. that had not have been the most efficient way. But she's making a choice to get there in a way that gives her a sense of control effectiveness. I have influence over how things go. I'm successful at managing what happens. Not just how it turns out, but how I get there, the journey. You might say to yourself something like, "I have control effectiveness when I know that each of my personal choices has a profound impact on my outcomes in life. Now, I can tell you this. Addicts value control effectiveness very heavily. Most of them do. Which is why recovery is so difficult. Because they feel like they're having control taken away from them to make their own choices. And at the end, I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Control effectiveness is really, really powerful. In fact, I can tell you that both truth and control effectiveness often trump value effectiveness. Here's an example. So in 2003, researchers studied rats, because that's what we do when we do research, we study rats. And they put these rats in cages, and they gave them a food dish full of food pellets that they could eat as freely as they wanted with no effort whatsoever. In that cage as well, there was a lever that the rat could push, and it would release a single food pellet, identical to the other food pellets, into a completely separate dish. And the researchers found that the rats actually preferred the pellets that were released by the lever. And they thought this was interesting, so they actually went and they took the bowl of free food and they put it in front of the lever. And they found that the rats would actually go in, push the free food out of the way. This is a lot of work. They'd push the free food out of the way, push the lever, and get a pellet. Okay? Rats valued control effectiveness over value effectiveness. Okay? They weren't just trying to get what they wanted. They wanted to make sure they had influence over how they obtained it. Isn't that amazing? It has incredible implications. In fact, all of this has a lot of implications. I'm going to focus on a pretty narrow band today, but this is actually new information for me as well. I'm still learning this stuff, and I'm working on applying it in my clinical practice. So over the years, as I do more presentations on the topic of motivation and recovery, I'll be applying it to other arenas of motivation and in recovery. Teenagers will often do this. You'll have a parent sit down, maybe you've done this. You'll sit down with a teenager and say, okay, look, your prefrontal cortex is totally busted right now. And it will be until you're about 25 to 27, depending on your gender. Women develop a couple years earlier. Okay? It's true. By about 25, you're good. By about 27, men are good to go. So you have better judgment until about 27. You probably still have better judgment after that. But you know, that the argument can be made that your prefrontal cortexes are fully developed at that point. So, teenagers, you sit down and you say, look, here's the deal. You could potentially make a lot of mistakes. And since I've been there before and I've been a teenager and I know what it's like, let me give you a few pointers of some things that you can do differently than I did or than other people do to help you live a happier, more fulfilled, enjoyable life. And then the teenager will say, no, let me make my own mistakes. They would rather fail and make mistakes and experience pain knowing that they had influence over that failure than to have a freebie and have a positive outcome. That is how powerful, and we do this too as adults, that is how powerful control effectiveness is. Okay, truth, value, and control effectiveness. This is what motivates people to do things. That we want to establish a sense of being effective. As I'm sitting here talking, you're thinking about some of the goals that you have in your life, perhaps recovery goals, perhaps goals that have nothing to do with recovery. And you're thinking about ways in which you're trying to meet those goals through the motivation of being effective. Okay? Now, if we're going to talk about motivation, we probably need to actually define, I love this picture. We're going to need to define what is motivation, right? He's going to need a lot of it to get up to the top of that hill there. So, motivation is a bit complex, of course, and if we were to try to define it, we might struggle to get a perfect definition. But here's a definition that I think is pretty reasonable. It's not perfect, but we could define motivation as energy directed at a goal or an outcome. It's fairly reasonable. Now, the thing that people make mistakes about, and And this is where we start getting into what needs to be different about the way we approach goals. The mistake that people make is assuming that motivation is an all-purpose universal energy that can be applied to any goal in any situation. It would be like assuming that I can take a bucket full of AA batteries and dump it into my gas tank of my car and just drive off. Or that I can dump gasoline all over my kids' toys and that they'll work properly. Okay? Motivation is not all-purpose energy. The thing that really matters is the fit. And this is the thesis of the entire presentation today. It's not the amount of energy you put into something. It's the fit between the way you're approaching your goals and what the goal is. And I'm going to start talking about examples. It's the fit that counts. Sometimes people won't be achieving their goals and they'll think, well, maybe I'm just not working hard enough. And that's rarely the case. Usually the case is not that you're not trying hard enough. It's that you don't have a good fit between the approach and the goal. So, there was a study performed with university students. They were split into groups. And they were all told that they were part of a study in which they were going to be learning the definitions for new words. Now, these were nonsense words. These are not words in the dictionary, words that no one had ever heard before. And they had to remember the words and what their definitions were, and that was the study. Now, I want to talk about two of the groupings of the participants in the study. They all received the same instruction, or both groups received the same instruction, that this is a really important task, that linguists were going to use the outcome of this to determine new words for the dictionary. So every participant in these two groups believed that they were doing something that was kind of a big deal. It was really important. But the two groups got a different set of instructions about how they were supposed to approach the task. One group was told that it was going to be probably pretty boring, and that it wasn't going to be very fun, but it was really important, so they should still try hard anyway. And the other group was told, hey, this is going to be really fun because they're cool words and interesting definitions, so have a fun time with this study. Okay? Two different instructions. They were simply predisposed to an idea of how they should be approaching the end result, which was the same end result, memorizing definitions of brand new words, and it was really a big deal. Now, you and I might reasonably assume, if we wanted to know which group performed best, which group did the very best at remembering the definitions, okay, performance on their goal, we might reasonably assume that the group that was told to have fun would do better. Because why would you perform well when you're told, this is going to be terrible, it's not going to be fun at all, I'm so sorry you have to be here, good luck, you know. It would be, you can imagine it would be tough to really get motivated to get anything done. But if you're told it's going to be fun, then maybe you would, you know, make some fun and it would be an enjoyable task. We do this with our kids sometimes too. Okay, go clean your room and have fun, you know, or something like that. Make it a game, you know. And that works till they're about three, and they're like, I think Dad's lying to me about this game. This doesn't feel like a game. And where's Dad, anyway? Why isn't he playing the game, right? So, but what the researchers found is that the people that were told it was going to be an unfun, kind of boring, and not exciting task performed better than the people that were told it was going to be fun. Now, if you're looking at this slide and I were to ask you the question, well, why is that the case? You would say, well, they had a better fit. And that's exactly right. An important task, something that really matters a lot, isn't actually a good fit for having a good time and having fun, right? It's like giving the two guys with the keys that are going to turn the keys and press the button to launch the nukes. Hey, this will be an exciting task. Have a great time, you know. It'll be fun. Turn those keys. It doesn't work like that. There is a fit that has to happen. And when you're told to have fun doing a really important task, it doesn't make sense. It's not a good fit. But when you're told, this isn't going to be very exciting, it's going to be kind of boring, but it's really important, and we need you to really pay attention, that fit works better. And that is the reason that people perform better. Okay? This is very new stuff. Okay? We're opening our minds to new So, motivation in goal pursuits is higher when the, what we're going to call this goal orientation, your approach to the goal. When your goal orientation fits the goal, your motivation is higher. There's more energy, and the energy becomes a better fit, and you're more likely to get things done. Sometimes in my very first therapy session with clients, I'll meet with a couple, and I usually get two types of addicts coming into the office. The one is they're usually both there, not because they want to be there, but one of them is there grumbling, complaining, maybe even arguing with me. You know, he's ready for the battle. And the other is there really, really overly excited about recovery, and I'm really worried about that guy, okay? Because I know something is wrong. Because he didn't probably make the choice to be there. He's there because his wife said, look, either do therapy with me or I'm out of here. And he's like, I think I'll pick therapy. Okay? So he's not there because he's excited about recovery. He's already been trying this for 20 years or whatever. He's not suddenly having all this great motivation. Okay? So I'm worried about the overly eager guy. The kind of anxious guy, the worried guy, or maybe even the fighter, I'm like, okay, we're going to be okay with this. Because eagerness is not a good fit with early recovery. So what I tell guys, and I'm going to go into that more in just a minute here with cool pictures. I'll often say this in the first session. Now, you would anticipate a therapist to be very loving and very kind, very gentle and highly motivating. You can do it. I believe in you. And I do all of that. However, when I'm trying to get a good fit in early recovery with an addict, sometimes I'll sit down and I'll say, look, here's the deal. This is really important. Probably about half my couples that start out are already separated and divorce is on the table. And so, you know, we're not starting off on a really great foot most of the time. So I'll say to the guy, this is really important. You're about to lose your family. So what we're doing here is probably more important than anything else you can possibly do right now in your life. So we're going to pay very close attention. And here's the deal. I can tell you right now, this is not going to be very fun. Okay? This is not going to be an exciting process. In fact, there are going to be times when you're not going to like me very much. And you're going to tell your wife, I hate that guy. I really don't want to talk to him anymore. In fact, I think he's probably the worst therapist of all time. And I want to see somebody else. Who doesn't make me work hard. And I say, you're not going to like me, and we'll work through it, because everybody hates me at some point in therapy, and that's just normal. Don't worry about it. We're good. I won't be offended. And this is going to be tough, and it's going to be really challenging. And I say, look, I want you to understand, I'm not a sadist. I don't enjoy your pain. But I know that pain is necessary for healing. And I immediately create what we call a good regulatory fit between his approach to recovery and the first goals of recovery. Because the initial goal of recovery for an addict is simply sobriety, trying not to relapse. Because we got to get this guy sober before we're going to get him evolving into the amazing human being that he needs to become. We just got to get him sober first. We need to get his neural pathways on the right track. We need to get his brain healed up. Depending on who you talk to, there's a period of time before the brain gets back to normal activity. It could be 90 days, somewhere in the, right around that mark of sobriety before you've got a normal functioning brain. So we've got to get him sober right off the bat. Now, we're going to come back to that in a minute. I'm just implanting that in your mind to think about for a minute. Let me talk about another study. There's a truck driving company. And the company CEO says, we're having too many accidents. My insurance premiums are through the roof. I've got to cut down on the number of accidents happening. And you might equate this to, I've got to cut down on the number of relapses happening in recovery. Okay? So the CEO says, all right, I'm going to come up with an incentive program. I'm going to motivate my drivers, my truck drivers, to do a better job at not having accidents. So he says, all right, at the end of the year, all of you who have not had an accident during the year, you get a bonus. So you get a monetary bonus. Here's a pile of money for not having an accident. It has no effect whatsoever on the number of accidents. And if I were to ask you why, you would say it's because it wasn't a good fit. And here's why. Because trying to go after a bonus requires eagerness. It's a promotion focus. I really want something. I'm going after it. But eagerness isn't a good approach to safe driving. I'm really eager. I'm getting out there. Okay, here we go. I'm going to not have an accident. Okay, that's the best way to have an accident. So the correct approach to not have an accident is vigilance. It's a prevention focus. So the company changes their approach, and they say, okay, here's the deal. Each of you truck drivers, you have a bonus sitting in an account waiting for you, ready to have at the end of the year. And you can have it as long as you don't have an accident in your vehicle. If you have an accident, we will take away the bonus. And driving performance improved. There were fewer accidents. Now, you might think to yourself, like I did, that seems so ridiculous. How can there possibly be a difference between saying you could earn a bonus or you could not lose a bonus? It seems semantic, but it's not. Because the way that you describe the goal changes the way that motivation works, because the goal orientation or the approach becomes different. So here we go. Now let's talk recovery. Usually people, when they're trying to motivate themselves to do something or motivate another person, they say, okay, I'm going to come up with something that I think will work for this person, so I'm going to come up with a reward, the carrot, right? And I'm going to dangle it over them until they do what I want. Or I'm going to come up with a punishment, the stick. And I'm going to threaten them with the stick if they don't do what I want. And so they say, okay, and then they say, and by the way, here's what you have to do in order to not get the stick and to get the carrot. But the thing that people miss out is the goal orientation. This is the thing that we need to change when we're working on motivation. We need to have the proper goal orientation. If not, we will be unsuccessful. So, and by the way, I believe, this is still a theory of mine, I'm still testing it clinically, I believe that partners, married partners, for example, need to have the same goal orientation in order for there to be a good match in recovery. Meaning you either need to both be vigilant and prevention focused, or you both need to be eager and promotion focused. And that needs to be facilitated. So, it's a feedback loop. If the desired end state doesn't work out the way you want, then you come back and you rethink your motivators and maybe your goal orientation. In early recovery, now, question. I have no idea what time I'm supposed to be done. Can someone tell me?
12:10.
So I've got 15 minutes. Fantastic. In early recovery, the primary goal for the addict is relapse prevention. We just need to get him sober. And if we're talking about truth, value, and control motivators, maybe his motivators are, I can be a sober person. I'm capable of sobriety. And my cautious behaviors can have an effect on whether or not I remain sober. And my main value motivator is I just want to stay married right now. The best orientation for relapse prevention is vigilance. Caution. Being careful. Not being home alone. Maybe not owning a smartphone. Calling a sponsor at the very first sign of a trigger. Being completely brutally honest about where he is at all moments, emotionally, physically, and otherwise. Has to be very, very vigilant. Or she has to be very, very vigilant if she is the one working through her addiction. In later recovery, this has to change. And this, my friends, I believe, is why people relapse a year, 2 years, and beyond into recovery, because they forget to change their goal and their goal orientation. They remain vigilant. But vigilance is tough to keep up for a long time, and it's hard to remain motivated to be vigilant when you haven't had a relapse in a long time. And so you think, well, I'm probably fine. The goal orientation and the goal has to change. The goal becomes health promotion. Physical health, emotional health, mental health, relational health, spiritual health. I'm becoming a better human being. Because we all know that addiction isn't just about relapsing into the behavior. It's about how addicts treat people. It's about how addicts perceive the world and their relationships. And if that doesn't change, then it kind of doesn't matter if they stay sober, because they're still not fun to live with. Right? You're like, yes, that's exactly right. Okay. So maybe his motivators change. I'm more than just an addict in recovery. I'm a human being that's growing and developing, becoming something more. My proactive behaviors will help me become more healthy. And what I really want in life is growth. So we're changing our effectiveness motivators, and the goal orientation becomes eagerness. He's really going after it. He's looking for opportunities to grow and develop. He's asking questions. What can I work on now? What's the next thing? What's the next step? It's a very different approach from the vigilant approach, just trying not to relapse. Now, so here's some examples of times in which you might do these. Vigilance might be important for early recovery. If he's in preoccupation and he's kind of like ramping up to a slip, he needs to transition back to vigilance. And I don't care if he's 2 years into, and he's got a year of sobriety, he's 2 years into recovery. Imagine this on a continuum, vigilance and eagerness. And imagine a pendulum swinging back and forth between these two stances. We're not trying to achieve balance. We're not trying to achieve a balance between eagerness and vigilance. We're trying to focus on the one that is going to promote the most likely positive outcome based on your goal. And you're going to swing back and forth the rest of your life to try to match where things are. And this requires evaluation. That means couples need to sit down together and say, hey, I think we're kind of in eagerness mode, and I think we need to switch back to vigilance right now because I'm worried about you because I've noticed you're kind of in preoccupation. Or you've got a trip coming up where you're going to Vegas for 3 days and you're going to be alone in a hotel room. We need to switch back to vigilance because eagerness is not going to be a good approach in Las Vegas. Okay? Avoiding, and it's real. This is real stuff, okay? This matters. Or avoiding consequences. If there's a major boundary with a consequence sitting around, then you need to be in vigilance mode. Later recovery is where eagerness happens. If there's established sobriety and you're actually working on the relationship. I don't work on marriages in early recovery because it's traumatizing to wives for me to ask them to be vulnerable with a guy who's lying to her and being generally a not nice person. Okay? Or personal growth goals. What are we working on now? When I see couples transitioning into this or individuals transitioning into this, I know we're in a good place because we figured out sobriety, but I always remind them we need to keep our eyes out and be ready to switch back to vigilance mode. Now, if you're a partner of an addict, in early recovery, your main goal is self-protection. I'm going to keep myself safe from this scary person who I love but is not treating me very well and is lying to me and whatnot. And your motivators might be, I need to establish truth that I am sane. I am not crazy. That my caution is warranted, and it actually helps me. When I'm cautious, I stay safer. And my main value effectiveness goal is I just need to stay safe. Okay? I can't keep falling into this. Vigilance is your approach. Checking on things. Asking lots of questions. Not trusting everything he says. Being very cautious. That is warranted. Some bad therapists will tell you, gosh, I just don't know why you're worrying so much about it. Just get over it. Stop worrying about whether he relapses. You're being codependent. I hate that. You're not being codependent. You're being vigilant. You're protecting yourself. It works perfectly. You're doing the exact right thing because you're not in eagerness mode yet. You don't have the goal to go there yet. In later recovery, your goal is also health promotion. How can I become the person I want to become? Okay, now I'm not in trauma, running around panic all the time. Things are a little bit better. What am I working on now? And maybe your goals are, I'm more than just the spouse of an addict. I'm a lot more than that. And my proactive efforts can help me to change into who I want, and what I really want is growth. And then your orientation becomes eagerness. And when that's the case, you are more likely to achieve the outcomes you're looking for. Now, yes, and when therapists do that, I'm going to smack them, okay? Because wife leads. Partner always leads. That's the rule. Addict does not lead because addict is too tainted, impaired, to make a good decision about whether eagerness is the appropriate approach, okay? So we're paying very close attention to the partner. We're saying, how safe are you? And I have evaluations every session to see if she's feeling safe. And she gives him explicit feedback about what he's doing that makes her feel safe and what he's doing that makes her feel unsafe. And until she's consistently rating herself high on the safety scale, and we are remaining in vigilance mode. And then when we're ready to transition wife or partner says, I think I'm starting to trust him. I think we need to work on some other stuff. Yeah, I kind of don't care that much about sobriety. I care about it, kind of. But what I really care about, especially with married people, is whether or not he's treating you well. Whether or not he's responding well to your needs. Whether he's listening to you. Is he holding your pain, or is he pushing it back on you, telling you he doesn't want to hear it? That's what I'm concerned about. I want to get him sober, and then we need to transition to that. So I don't care if he's got 3 years of sobriety under his belt. If wife comes in and says, I still don't trust this guy, I don't feel safe with him, the first thing I'm going to ask is, have you done a full therapeutic disclosure? And almost always they say no. And I say, no wonder you don't trust him. You still have no idea what he's actually done and what he hasn't done. You're still sitting on no information. You don't have truth effectiveness because you don't know what's real. So the husband needs to transform into maybe eagerness, depending on where the wife is. But she may say, I'm still feeling unsafe with you. So what I need is you to be proactive about helping me be safe. Now, this is where you kind of have more of a balance. You're more in the middle, and that is something like this. I'm cautious. This is an addict saying, I'm cautious about triggering her trauma. Okay? I'm being very vigilant about the things I do, the things I say, the things I don't do, the things I don't say that trigger her into trauma and make her feel unsafe. That's different than eagerness. Like, all right, we're going to have a great marriage. Let's do it. Let's go on a date on Friday night and talk about life. That's different. That doesn't heal until both people are ready to go there. Okay. So, for partners, you're going to be vigilant in early recovery. If you're worried about that, he's still lying to you, get risky situations. If you're still enforcing boundaries with him and he's not listening, then you still need to be in vigilance mode. And every single time he says, I'm fine, you're in vigilance mode. Because that's a lie. Okay? I'm fine. Oh, cool, so you completely unplugged from your emotions. Great. That's what that means. I'm fine. Okay? You're going to switch to eagerness when you're in later recovery, when you're trusting that his sobriety is real, and you're feeling safe, not just the sobriety, but you're feeling safe with him. You're working on the relationship, you're working on yourself, and when he says, yeah, I hear what you're saying. Yeah, I don't blame you for feeling scared, because I haven't given you a very good reason to trust me. So I don't blame you. What can we do? That when I hear that, okay, we're going to talk about eagerness, maybe, we'll see. Yeah, and that's going to be about surrender. Thank you for the transition, that was so beautiful. that was almost like a plant, okay? This is what people typically feel like when they're about to surrender, right? There's sharp rocks and lava and all kinds of scary stuff down there. So here's what we're going to finish off with today. And I've got, 4 minutes? Does that sound about right? Okay. People get really scared of surrender because it feels like it undermines their control effectiveness. If I surrender, I lose control. And then I don't feel effective in that area. And I freak out. And then I go back to doing what I want again. Okay? I want to help you. And in the next presentation I'm doing, I'm going to go really deep into this conversation about what is surrender. But I want to help you rethink about surrender. And this is particularly important for addicts. Okay? Researchers had children try to put together anagrams. So mixed up words, and I'm going to try to come up with the right word. I think that's an anagram. It sounds about right. We'll assume that it is. And children were given the option. Some children in research group one got to pick what color marker they were going to use to do the anagrams and which ones they would do. Children in group two had a parent pick for them. The parent picked the marker, and the parent picked which anagrams they were going to do. And what the researchers found was that the children who felt that their control had been taken away from them by their parent weren't as interested in doing the anagrams, and they didn't fare as well. However, having the parent select for them was not necessarily a detriment to them. If the child perceived it as either an us decision, my parent helped me, we're making a decision together, or the child felt that the parent was making a decision that was in their best interest, that would help them, then they still perceived themselves to have control effectiveness. So surrender is not a loss of control when it's done right. If an addict can perceive the choice, and this is some of the work I have to do with them in therapy, if they can perceive the choice to surrender to the needs of the spouse, I hear what you're saying. I hear how unsafe you feel. Okay? I'm going to listen to that. Then they don't perceive a loss of control effectiveness because it is a we, it is an us decision. The other situation is when an addict makes a decision to surrender. You can apply this to yourselves as well. Makes a decision to surrender to someone they perceive to be more competent and capable of making a decision that will have a good outcome for them. Then that is called a proxy agent. I choose to allow you to make the decision for me because I trust your judgment. The choice is still there. The sense of control effectiveness remains intact, but the outcome becomes better. The costs are lower. And that creates greater motivation in people. So actually, as it turns out, surrender is a very powerful behavior motivator because it minimizes costs and it maintains control effectiveness. Thank you very much. Proxy agent. And that is the end, friends. Thank you.